Chapter 8. Most of the time, the oceans appear to be at rest. Unending waves no higher than the head of a German shepherd give the image of a sleeping giant, the surface of his chest slowly rising and falling with each breath. It is an illusion that beguiles the unwary. Sailors could fall asleep in their berths with clear skies and calm seas and wake up to a frenzied sea that quickly swept over thousands of square miles, engulfing every vessel in its path. Hurricane Lizzie had all the ingredients for unmitigated disaster. If she looked nasty by morning, she was downright rotten by noon and a shrieking hellion by evening. 220-mile-an-hour winds soon passed 250. They hurled and whipped the once flat water into a giant turmoil that rose and fell 100 feet between crest and trough as it advanced relentlessly toward Navidad Bank and the Dominican Republic, its first landfall. The anchor was barely up and the sea sprite underway when Paul Barnum turned for perhaps the 20th time and stared over the sea to the east. Earlier, he noted no change. But this time the horizon where the Tanzanite blue water met a sapphire blue sky was smudged by a dark gray streak like a distant Chinook dust storm rolling over the prairie. Barnum gazed at the advancing nightmare, stunned by how rapidly it grew and began filling the sky. He had never experienced, nor had he conceived, that a storm could move with what seemed the speed of an express train. Even before he could program the computerized automated controls for course and speed, the storm was covering the sun in a death shroud while painting the sky the lead gray on the bottom of a well-used skillet. For the next 8 hours, Sea Sprite ran hard as Barnum drove her in what seemed a futile attempt to put as much distance as possible between her hull and the sharp coral of Navidad Reef. But when he realized the worst of the storm was about to overtake him, he knew the most efficient way to survive was to head right into it, relying on Sea Sprite to fight her way through. He patted her helm affectionately, as if she was flesh and blood instead of cold steel. She was a staunch ship that had taken everything the sea could throw at her in her years of rigorous sailing in the polar regions. She might be mauled and hammered, but Barnum didn't doubt she would survive. He turned to his first officer, Sam Maverick, who looked like a high school dropout with his long red hair, shaggy beard, and gold pendant dangling from his left ear. "Program a new course, Mr. Maverick. Bring her around on a heading of 85 degrees east. We can't outrun the storm, so we'll ride into her bow on." Maverick looked at the seas that were cresting a good 50 feet over the stern and shook his head. He stared balefully at Barnum as if his captain had lost half his gray matter. "You want to bring her around in this sea?" he asked slowly. "No time like the present," replied Barnum. "Better now than when the rogue waves hit." It was ship's handling at its most frightening. For an agonizing length of time, the ship's hull would swing and face the waves along her entire beam, leaving her vulnerable to a massive wave that would roll her over. Many a ship through the centuries was capsized by attempting the maneuver, going to the bottom without leaving a trace. "When I see an interval between the swells, at my command, give her full speed." Then he spoke into the ship's radio. "We're coming around in a heavy sea. Everyone brace yourselves and hold on for dear life." Hunched over the console in front of the bridge window, Barnum gazed unblinkingly through the windshield and waited with the patience of a rock until he saw a wave coming that was higher than any that had passed. "Full speed, if you please, Mr. Maverick." Maverick instantly obeyed Barnum's order, but was horrified, certain of disaster as an enormous wave bore down on the research ship. He was about to curse Barnum for turning too soon, but realized what the captain had in mind. There were no timely intervals. The monstrous waves almost seemed to mesh on one another, like soldiers marching in close formation. Barnum had jumped the gun and begun the turn early, gaining a precious minute while the ship took the brunt of the wave on an angle. The implacable wave tossed the bow up and shoved Sea Sprite almost over to her port side before sweeping her over and around. For 15 seconds, the ship was overwhelmed by a seething white mass of water as she struggled partially through the crest that towered above the bridge. Then she was fishtailing viciously down the other side, rolling heavily to port, the sea inundating her deck railings. Almost miraculously, with agonizing slowness, she righted in the trough and took the next sea bow on, plunging through on an even keel. Maverick had walked ship's decks for 18 years, but he had never seen a more professional, more intuitive display of seamanship. He stared at Barnum and was amazed to see a smile. Perhaps a grim smile, but a smile nonetheless on the captain's face. My God, Maverick thought. The man is actually enjoying himself. 50 miles to the south of Sea Sprite, the outer edge of Hurricane Lizzie was within minutes of slamming into the Ocean Wanderer. The forward edge of the menacing clouds swept past, cutting off the sun and plunging the sea into an eerie gray darkness. A dense sheet of rain followed, pelting the windows of the floating hotel like the blast from 1,000 machine guns. Too late, Morton moaned to himself while standing in his office staring at the tumult that was headed directly for the hotel as if it was an enraged Tyrannosaurus Rex with a vendetta. Despite the warnings and updates from Heidi Lischerness at the Hurricane Center, he did not conceive the incredible speed and distance the rampage had traveled since morning. Though Heidi Lischerness had given him up-to-date forecasts on the magnitude and speed, it didn't seem possible that calm seas and quiet skies could turn so fast. He could not believe Lizzie's forward fringe was already assaulting the building. "Inform every staff director to assemble in the conference room immediately," he snapped to his executive secretary as he marched into his office. His anger at Spectre's indecision to evacuate 1,100 guests and employees when there was still a chance of transporting them to safety in the Dominican Republic only a few scant miles away bordered on fury. He became even more infuriated as the sound of aircraft engines warming up vibrated the windows. He walked over and stared below just in time to see Spectre and his entourage board the Bereyev BE-210 executive jet. The entry hatch was barely closed before the engines revved up and the plane began gathering speed, planing over the rising waves, throwing great billowing sheets of spray before lifting into the air and banking on a course toward the Dominican Republic. "You rotten, cowardly scum," Morton hissed at seeing Spectre flee for his life without the least concern for the 1,100 souls he left behind. He watched until the plane was lost in the menacing clouds and turned as his staff entered and gathered around the conference table. It was obvious by the expressions of apprehension on their faces that they were standing on the fine line between calm and panic. "We underestimated the speed of the hurricane," he began. "Its full force is less than an hour away. Since it's too late to evacuate, we must move all guests and employees to the upper level of the hotel, where it's the safest." "Can't the tugboats pull us out of harm's way?" inquired the reservations director, a tall, perfectly groomed lady of 35. "The tugs were alerted early and should arrive shortly, but a rising sea will make it extremely difficult for them to make a connection with our towing capstans. If the procedure proves impossible, then we have no choice but to weather the storm." The concierge raised his hand. "Wouldn't it be safer to ride out the storm on the guest floors below the surface?" asked the concierge. Morton slowly shook his head. "If the worst happens and the crush of the storm waves break our mooring lines, and the hotel drifts..." He paused and shrugged his shoulders. "I don't want to think about what would happen if we are driven onto Navidad Bank 40 miles to the east, or onto a rocky shoreline of the Dominican Republic that would tear out the glass walls of the lower floors." The concierge noted. "We understand. Once the water flooded into the lower levels, the ballast tanks could not keep the hotel afloat and the waves would bash her to pieces on the rocks."
"And if it looks like that will happen?" asked Morton's assistant manager. Morton's face turned very solemn indeed as he looked around the conference table. "Then we abandon the hotel, enter the life rafts, and pray to God a few will survive."